FBI agents hunting for the deadly Unabomber have detained a Montana man described as a hermit. For 18 years now, the FBI has been searching for the Unabomber. Over the years, three people have been killed and 23 have been injured.
David Kaczynski was an expert in family relations. Born in Chicago, after college, he started a job in social work. By the mid-90s, Kaczynski was running a youth shelter in Albany, New York, where he helped the children of troubled families, victims of abuse, and those who'd been in trouble with the police. But in the summer of 1995, worries about his own family meant that David Kaczynski had a choice to make.
August of 1995, I was on a plane to Paris, and I was going to join my wife for a kind of second honeymoon. When I got off the plane in the cab on the way from the airport to our hotel, Linda mentioned that she had something very important to discuss with me, and she seemed very concerned. I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Not here, not in public." And it actually wasn't until I'd caught a few winks and we were strolling around Paris that she told me something that had been on her mind for a couple of weeks. She'd been reading some of the reports about the Unabomber, a serial bomber who had placed, I think, 16 bombs over a period of 17 years, had killed three people, was certainly at the top of the FBI's most wanted list. And, you know, Linda said, did you ever consider the remote possibility that the Unabomber could be your brother, Ted? You know, my first reaction was one of complete surprise. I guess my second reaction was one of some defensiveness. And, you know, after all, this is my brother she's talking about. He had a long history of mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia. And as a result, he had isolated himself from other human beings. He had not been close to the family, had actually kind of disowned me around the time of my marriage to Linda. And I'm thinking, you know, she's taking this awfully personally. Linda at that point shared with me some information that, you know, she had gleaned from the newspaper, and that was that the law enforcement believed that the Unabomber had been born in Chicago since the first bombs had been planted there. And Linda, Ted, and I had all been born in Chicago. She also found out that a bomb had been planted in a student lounge at the University of California at Berkeley. And she knew that my brother had once been assistant professor of mathematics at the University of California at Berkeley. And then she said that apparently the Unabomber had sent a long letter to the newspapers and to the FBI insisting that it be published. Apparently it was a long tract explaining his reasons for these series of bombings over many years. It was known to be an anti-technology treatise, something that said the technology was harmful for human beings, and this is what the Unabomber was protesting. Well, Linda knew that my brother had left his job as a professor, had gone out to live in a little cabin in the woods out in Montana, claiming similar ideas to the Unabomber's. Basically, the technology was evil, it was wrong, it was destructive. And my response to Linda was to say, you know, I know my brother. You've never met him. We grew up together. We shared a bedroom as boys. You know, Ted is not a violent person. He's simply incapable of doing what the Unabomber has done. I guess where we left it at that point was that Linda asked me to make a promise, and the promise was that if the manifesto that the Unabomber had sent to the newspapers was ever published, I would take the time to read it. I would think about it and let her know if I thought the writing, the thought process resembled my brother's.
Within weeks, and with the agreement of the FBI, the Washington Post newspaper published the Unabomber's 35,000-word manifesto as an 8-page supplement. In a country consumed with the mystery of the Unabomber, America's most feared terrorist, it was a national sensation.
I went to a couple of those newsstands, and either they didn't carry the post or the issue had sold out very, very quickly because of the Unabomber's manifesto that was published in it. And I was sort of thinking, well, you know, I guess it just wasn't to be. It's probably not Ted. It was actually maybe about a week, 7 or 8 days later, when Linda had learned that it had been posted on the Internet. Now, Linda is a university professor, we went to the library at her university. And here I am sitting and looking at the screen. Linda, I realize, is not looking at the screen. She's actually looking at my face. I think she realized that the words on the screen would tell her less than the look on my face. And believe me, I was all prepared to, you know, read the first paragraph, find something that disqualified it in my mind as Ted's writing. I was going to turn to Linda and say, "You've been really silly. It's not Ted. I can tell you that for sure." Unfortunately, as I read that first paragraph, that first page, I felt a kind of tightness in my chest. I almost felt in a strange way, almost emotionally, the way I had felt when I had received some of Ted's angry letters the year before. But I remember as we walked out of the library, Linda whispering to me, "Well, what do you think, David? Do you think there's a possibility that your brother wrote that?" And, you know, I said, I have to admit there's some parts of this manifesto that sound like Ted. There are other parts of this I really can't connect with. If I had to estimate, I'd say maybe at most there's one chance in 1,000 that Ted might have written it. So here we are walking across the campus toward the parking lot. Linda's kind of quiet for a minute or so, and then she says, "David, you know, one chance in 1,000 that your brother is the most wanted person in America? I mean, maybe we need to look into this. Maybe we need to find the truth." You know, for the next 3 or 4 weeks, Linda and I made a real study of the manifesto, and we thought we could find the truth by reading deeply into this long manifesto. We also had the advantage of a number of letters that my brother had sent me over the years, many of them talking about his concerns about technology. So Linda and I would come home from work, we'd have dinner, we'd go to our living room, sit down on this little couch we have there, and it, for me, it was kind of like a roller coaster, because there were days I'd just kind of look up and say, "Have I lost my mind? I mean, what am I doing? My brother's the Unabomber. That can't be." Then the next day, I'd be reading some passage in the manifesto, and I would almost like hear my brother's voice in it. And it was, you know, kind of devastating. And I'd say, "Well, it just sounds like Ted. How can it not be Ted?" And I remember that, you know, one morning I woke up with a very powerful feeling of depression. You know, it was like, you know, my first waking thought as I sat up in bed was, "Gee, that was the worst nightmare I've ever had in my life." But then as the cobwebs melted and I began to realize it wasn't really a nightmare, I was really considering the possibility that my brother was a serial murderer, America's most notorious criminal at the time. I remember walking out of the bedroom to the kitchen, sitting down at our kitchen table. Linda was already sitting there eating a bowl of cornflakes. And, you know, without even necessarily planning what I was going to say, I just looked up at her, our eyes kind of locked, and I said, "You know, hon, I think there might be a 50-50 chance that Ted wrote the manifesto." So for the rest of that day, we were just wrestling with it. I mean, back and forth, is he or isn't he? But maybe, you know, more poignantly, you know, what does this ask of us? Do we have the responsibility to do something at this moment? By nightfall, you know, we're getting more confused and we don't know what to do. And we're almost thinking, well, maybe if we sleep on it, maybe we'll wake up in the morning and we'll look at it fresh and we'll know what to do. But you understand, it wasn't very easy to fall asleep. So here we are lying side by side in bed. And I began struggling with this other issue. Like, who is my brother? Do I really know this man? I'm kind of reminiscing, and Linda's there listening quietly to me. I told her that when I was about 3 years old, our family had moved from an inner-city neighborhood in the city, from an apartment, out to a little house of our own in the suburbs. And since it was summer when we moved, I used to push my way out through a screen door that we had in the back. But it was always a challenge to try to get back inside the house because, you know, the door handle on the screen door was too high. I couldn't reach it. I was too short. And then one day, Ted, who was about 7 years older than me, came out of the house, and I saw him fiddling around with something at the back door, and I kind of walked up there thinking, what's Teddy doing? And he had taken a spool of thread from our mother's sewing kit, and he'd gotten a hammer and nail from our father's toolkit in the basement. When he's done, he says, "Dave, see if this works." And all of a sudden, you know, a light bulb goes off. I realize, wow, my brother's made me a little door handle. So anyway, you know, I hadn't thought of that in years, but here it is 42 years later. I'm struggling with this awful suspicion. Is my brother the Unabomber? And whoa, this, you know, this story floats up from the past. And as I'm sharing this story with Linda, I hear a little sound, and I kind of glance over at her face on the pillow next to mine. And the room was dark, but there was enough light coming through a shade from a street lamp outside so that I could see her face was just flooded with tears, because it was the first time that she really understood that, you know, Ted wasn't just out there a nut, maybe even a violent person out in the woods of Montana. He was inside me. You know, understanding that Ted was a human being with human qualities didn't make our dilemma any easier. In effect, it really intensified it, because we found ourselves in a position at that point where any choice we made, anything we did, could lead to somebody's death. You know, if we decided to, you know, protect a family member, not say anything, just hope for the best, you know, we might wake up someday and realize some other person had been killed, that Ted was the person responsible. Of course, the other horn of this dilemma was the realization that if anyone was making a short list at that time in history about who deserved the death penalty, people would have said, well, certainly if they ever catch this Unabomber, he's one guy who's got to be put to death. So I had to consider what it would feel like to go through the rest of my life if Ted was found guilty and condemned to death and executed with my own brother's blood on my hands. Of course, I thought about the impact on Ted. He had isolated himself from other human beings, but I recall receiving a letter from him one year in which he had told me that I was the only person he'd ever really cared about in his entire life. So I had to think, what would it feel like for him to be turned in by the only person whose affection he really reciprocated? But I would have to say, even more than my concern for Ted and my concern for my own peace of mind was my worry about our mother. At this point, she was a 79-year-old widow. For years and years, she had been consumed with worry about her elder son because of his mental illness, because of his estrangement from the family. At that point, I just thought, I can't tell Mom. You know, I was afraid she might die of a heart attack or a stroke.
By now, David had resolved to act. But how? Despite his wife's concern for his safety, David wanted to visit his brother in Montana and wrote him a letter with this suggestion.
A couple of weeks went by, and I remember I came home from work a little early that day, so I was home alone when I retrieved Ted's letter from our mailbox, and, you know, holding the letter in my hand, almost feeling my hands kind of shake and, you know, sort of thinking of it as a kind of moment of truth. And then when I opened the letter, it was quite devastating, because Ted's first line was that he really did not consider me to be his brother anymore, and that I should leave him alone, and he wanted no contact with me now or ever. It made me feel that Linda was probably right when she said, you know, it could be disaster if I went out and visited him. I thought, you know, Ted was very fragile, very mentally unstable, and that this was more than I could handle myself. We contacted a retired FBI agent who had a consulting company that did language analysis, and we paid this man to run a comparison between some of my brother's letters and the Unabomber manifesto. I remember it was New Year's Eve when I got the phone call describing the report. A friend of ours who acted as an intermediary actually read me the report over the telephone, and she first said, David, are you sitting down? I think you should be sitting down. And they said three different experts had agreed that there was approximately a 60% possibility that the person who had written the letters my brother had sent to me had also written the Unabomber's manifesto. And I think it was really at that point where we understood that our decision was made, that if we did nothing, there was a real possibility that other innocent people might be blown to bits.
The FBI had put up a $1 million reward for information leading to the Unabomber's capture. After the manifesto was published, the Unabomber hotline was receiving over 1,000 calls a day from people who thought they knew who he was. Knowing that he would have trouble getting the investigators' attention, David hired a Washington, D.C. lawyer to make contact.
I thought perhaps in return for providing information that would lead them to my brother, they would agree to take the death penalty off the table. When the attorney basically told me there was no way to take the death penalty off the table, I said, well, you know, my wife and I have decided that we need to do whatever is necessary to stop the violence, and hopefully they're going to find out that Ted is not the person. So our attorney actually began to make some contacts with the FBI. The answer he got was that they were kind of mildly interested, not awfully interested. We even sent them some of Ted's letters. Nothing seemed to ring a bell with them. They just said, we'll be in touch, basically.
But within just weeks, the FBI's indifference to David would be shaken by a discovery that he made on a visit to his mother's house. It was a 22-page essay by his brother on the evils of technology. To David, it was remarkably similar to the Unabomber Manifesto, and he sent it on to the FBI.
I got a very urgent call from the attorney who said that agents from the Unabomber Task Force wanted to visit with me and my wife down in Washington, D.C. And so we agreed to fly down to Washington and visit with them. The night before, as I was driving home from work, I felt chest pains. I felt an anxiety. It felt like at that point I knew that my life was probably never, ever going to be the same. I remember when we walked into the attorney's office, there were two agents from the FBI sitting there. And it was very uncomfortable to sit there and talk to complete strangers, police officers at that, about, you know, details of our family history I wouldn't have shared maybe with some of my closest friends. In fact, you know, we had asked them for some promises, and one of the promises we asked them for was anonymity. There is a kind of status in the American criminal system where a person can achieve status as a confidential informant, and in that case, law enforcement gives a solemn promise that they will not be identified and that they will be protected. We met with the officers for 2 days running, 12 hours the first day, about 8 hours the second day. And at the end of our second meeting with the FBI, one of the agents came back in the room and kind of unscrolled a map of rural Montana on the desk in the conference room of our attorney's office. And it was one of those very detailed topographic maps with blue walls and roads and back roads. And, you know, he said, David, this is a topographic map of the county where your brother lives. Could you point out the spot where his cabin is located? And so I kind of walked up to the table and looked at it and, you know, kind of gingerly put my finger down on the spot where I thought Ted's cabin was. And, you know, believe me, you know, the die was cast. We had made our decision. We were resolved to do what we thought we had to do. But I can't tell you how painful it was that moment to realize that, you know, my putting my finger down on the map could be sending my own brother to his death.
Still hopeful that the FBI's investigations would allow them to eliminate Ted as a suspect, David had so far managed to hide his fears from his mother. But further research by the FBI only increased their interest in Ted. And before long, they insisted on a meeting with Mrs. Kaczynski.
About 3 days later, it was Saturday morning, I remember walking up the steps to my mom's apartment. I remember knocking on her door and seeing Mom open the door. I see her smile turn to a sudden look of dismay, and she says, David, you look terrible. You know, is there something wrong? Has something happened? And at that point, I said, Mom, I think you better sit down. I have something very troubling to tell you. I remember Mom sat down in this little lazy boy chair. I always picture her sitting in that chair. I'm unable to sit down. I'm so agitated. I'm kind of pacing the floor back and forth. I began by, you know, talking about the Unabomber and thinking about places the Unabomber had been. And then I pointed out that Ted had also frequented some of those places. Mom got very, very quiet. I remember her just sitting in that chair, kind of gazing at me with a fixed look of horror on her face. And anyway, I said, "Mom, you know, I'm really terrified. I think there's a chance Ted might be involved. Mom, I've actually gone to the FBI. I've shared my suspicions. They're currently investigating." And I'll never forget what Mom did next. Without saying a word, she got up out of her chair. She walked over to where I was standing. She's a tiny little woman. She's under 5 feet tall. I'm a shade over 6 feet tall. And she just reached her arms up around my neck and pulled me down so that she could reach my cheek to put a kiss on my cheek. And then she said, "David, I can't imagine what you've been struggling with." And the next thing she said was, "David, Ted's never been violent, right? Can you ever remember him being violent? You know, he has a sensitive side. He loves animals, children. You know, they're going to investigate it. They're going to find out Ted's completely innocent." And I said, "Mom, I hope and pray you're right. There's something else I have to ask you. Is there any chance you'd be willing to speak with the FBI? They're very interested in speaking with you." And she said, "Well, when do they want to speak with me?" And it was at that moment that I had to tell Mom that there were actually three agents waiting outside her apartment building. They were just waiting for a signal from me at the window to come up. And, you know, I said, "Mom, they're really outside. They want to speak to you now." So the agents walked up the stairs. You know, here they are in Mom's living room. And what does Mom do? She offers them coffee. You know, she's trying to think, how do I handle this? And, you know, she comes back and they say, "Mrs. Kaczynski, is there anything you could help us with to carry this investigation forward? Anything like old letters, any photographs?" So what happens when you put together a mom with family photographs? You get stories, right? And so basically I hear her saying, you know, we were a good family. Look, we did all these wonderful things. We went on vacation. You know, Ted was a good kid. Here he graduated from school. You know, you're looking for the Unabomber. We'll do anything in our power to help you. But understand, you know, you're not going to find the Unabomber in a family like ours.
But matters were now very much out of the family's hands. And far away in the remote hills of Montana, heavily armed FBI agents were closing in on a tiny cabin.
I first got wind that something was up on April 3rd, 1996. I was sitting in a case review at the youth shelter in Albany when our administrative assistant came in the room. She handed me a piece of paper, and it said that, you know, somebody from CBS News in New York would like to talk to you. You know, she had like a very puzzled look on her face, like, "What's this about?" And I just looked at her and kind of mouthed the word "later." You know, about 10 minutes later, she comes in with another message from another reporter, and I realize something is happening. So I quickly left the conference room, went back to my office, called Linda, and I said, "Linda, something's up. I think we better get to Mom's apartment so that she's not alone when she hears about this." And Linda and I kind of met on the doorstep of the apartment building. Linda told me she'd already changed some of the phone numbers, and we walk upstairs and we explain that, you know, we better turn on the TV, maybe something's happening. And you know, here we are, the three of us sitting on Mom's couch, peering at the television screen when the story is broken. And we saw the image of Ted's arrest on the screen. He was being led out of his cabin between two federal marshals. Ted, at this point, weighed, I think, 122 pounds. It's just literally skin and bones. FBI agents said that there were actually pieces of his clothing falling off of his body as he walked. He had not bathed in months and months and months. He had a kind of glazed look in his eye, and you know, a part of me is saying, "Oh my God, Ted, has it come to all of this?" And another part of me just wanted to be there with him. You know, he must have been the loneliest person in the universe at that moment. And but we also realized that just about everybody else in America, and I suppose around the world, looking at that same image, did not see, you know, a brother, did not know our story. did not know about his mental illness. All they really saw was the monster who had carried out these cruel bombings.
After 10 years of searching for the man shown in this sketch, the FBI finally descended on the Montana wilderness, where they found a mailbox with the name Ted Kaczynski and a tiny cabin.
I can't tell you what it, you know, just what it feels like to hear your family's name in this context and to realize at that moment that your good family name is going to mean something else to people in the future. It's going to be associated with murder, violence, terrorism, madness. I felt a deep sense of betrayal when the government broke its promise of confidentiality. And since we were hung out to dry, our home was surrounded by media for about 10 days. We couldn't even step outside for fear of being, assaulted with questions and television cameras.
When the cabin was searched, it revealed a treasure trove of evidence against David's brother, including a live bomb ready to be sent in the post and original copies of the famous manifesto.
The only question really that remained for the criminal justice system was whether the Unabomber lives or dies at this point. Does he spend the rest of his life in prison or is he executed? And clearly the answer to that question, I thought, hinged appropriately on Ted's mental condition. We thought it was pretty clear that an honest assessment of Ted would find that he was suffering from schizophrenia. I assumed, as it turned out very naively, that there would not be an attempt to execute someone with a serious mental illness. And to me, it felt like a betrayal because, you know, our family had come forward with very, very heavy, aching hearts, simply trying to do what we felt morally impelled to do, which was protect other people. We were seeking truth and justice, but we realized at this point that the government was no longer interested in truth and justice. They had a political agenda, and that was to, put to death a man who had terrorized the country and taunted the FBI and eluded escape for so many years.
In preparation for the court case, it was eventually proved that Ted Kaczynski did indeed suffer from paranoid schizophrenia. A plea bargain was agreed, sparing him the death penalty, and in exchange, he pleaded guilty to the Unabomber crimes and is serving life in prison without parole. The Kaczynskis donated their $1 million reward to victims of the Unabomber. Since his imprisonment, David and his mother have written to Ted every month, but have never received any response.